hole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host today, July 1st, Canada Day. The Old Mole is a kind of radio magazine. We got interviews, we got commentaries, reviews, analysis, news review. We all consider ourselves socialists and feminists of one stripe or another, committed to a world that is free of class hierarchy, racial hierarchy, sexual, and other forms of hierarchy, where the world is shared in common, where the world is not plundered in common, and where we can all thrive in common. On today's show, we are going to be exploring some of the roots of our political views and movements. Bill Resnick is going to be reviewing the PBS American Experience documentary on Emma Goldman that rebroadcast for her 150th birthday this weekend and again tonight. If you have access to OPB's digital side channel, OPB Plus, you can watch it there tonight at 9 a.m. or 9 p.m., but you could also just find it online still through the PBS website. Just look up Emma Goldman, American Experience. Later on the show, Bill Resnick will also be offering us a commentary on the position of students in society now, considering them as agents for political action, political organizing, and agitation. You know, The 60s were known as a time when the students rose up, but then everybody started becoming a student. And, you know, that has changed the whole fabric of society with the way that we all carry these debts. And he's going to be considering the politics of that situation today. Jan Hocken and Denise Morris are going to be reviewing a classic American film about American greatness and overcoming adversity, Rocky. They're going to be considering that movie in light of 4th of July coming up in a few days. And later in the show, Jan will return to talk with Sophie Smith about the humanitarian court trial, humanitarian aid worker court trial, where the humanitarian worker was just leaving food and water out in the desert for refugees to come by, and they wanted to try him as a terrorist. And in the middle of the show, I'll be talking with Guy Berliner about a subject that comes up for me a lot. That's mindfulness and mindfulness meditation in the context of capitalism and it as a workplace stress reduction strategy, but also potentially as something to rouse our liberatory aspirations. You can listen to The Old Mole at kboo.fm/oldmole and catch previous episodes with our segments and materials. And you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter by just looking for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Now we're going to turn to Bill Resnick to review Emma Goldman, The American Experience documentary. Bill?
Yes, Joe, thank you. The documentary film, Emma Goldman, A Dangerous Woman, played on public television here. I saw it last Friday evening. It's again going to be played tonight at 9 a.m. on OPB Plus. I was going to interview Candace Falk, who directs the Emma Goldman Papers Project, and she spent her life collecting Goldman materials and writing books and articles about her. At the last minute, Candace had to step back, but we had previously prepared for the interview. She urged me to review the film. I'm going to do it based on her analysis. To start, I'm quoting Candace, "The film was wonderful and terrible." First, the wonderful about the film. Candace Falk was thrilled that Emma Goldman was getting more attention being played on public TV. That's because her personality, her wit, her radicalism were so powerful, cinematic, and exciting that even the brief glimpses of her that we saw in that documentary were memorable and would send viewers to learn more. And further, it did present the capitalist predation and brutality that Goldman encountered, and she was a factory worker at age 16. she lived through that brutality and fought it. And it included the documentary did include photographs and a recounting of the impunity of the rich, and especially in the cold-blooded premeditated murder of protesters and strikers at Haymarket, Homestead, and many other places, east and west and south and north. The film surely had an anti-capitalist tone, at least in those years that covered, roughly 1880 to 1940. But mostly it was disappointing, I'm afraid, although worth seeing, because we only saw those glimpses of Emmy Goldman. That's not for want of material. She died in 1940. Still sharp, committed, left a huge trove of writings, recordings, books, a 1,000-page autobiography, thousands of photographs, many mugshots taken after her numerous arrests, denunciations of her by politicians, newspapers, and law enforcement. She really was the most dangerous woman in America, said the FBI. And also she left old recordings and watchable video of her speeches and lectures and her proud bearing. And of course there were many biographies of Goldman, one by Candace Falk. The filmmakers of this latest documentary did have full access to that whole rich, overflowing material collected by the Emmy Goldman Papers Project that Candace Falk founded and still directs. But despite full access, the film had little from Goldman. It was mostly, little but really interesting, from Goldman. It was mostly talking heads, nearly all of them male, discussing and analyzing Goldman against the background of the important struggles of her age. And Goldman entered every one of those great struggles for the 40-hour day, 40-hour week, and sometimes it feels like a 40-hour day, for the 40-hour week and living wages, for free speech, for sexual freedom, women's emancipation. She was a great anti-war agitator. In fact, was kicked out of the country, deported because of that in World War I. And all the while, she's fighting for worker power. For her, these reform struggles prepared working people for the struggle for a new society. The film did have some talking heads that admired Goldman, like Tony Kushner and Barry Pateman, an anarchist historian, but these fellows were edited to only discuss her passion for justice, her commitment to working people, her tireless struggles, whereas the historians critical of her, smug, condescending, described her as committed, yes, clever, brilliant speaker, completely right in attacking and trying to change that period's capitalism. But that said, they compared her to the snake oil salesman of that period, promising miracle cures. Their basic message was she was naive in fighting for democratic socialism and participatory radical democracy, naive for believing that self-governing socialism was possible and a worthy goal, naive for believing that a fantasy, they thought, that ordinary workers could successfully run factories and shops. One prime example of the film's rejection of Goldman's deepest purposes and ideals, it showed her, and it was a liberal film, they liked her. The film showed her imprisonment and then deportation from the U.S. for criticizing U.S. entry into World War II, World War I, an imperialist war. Since the Europeans wouldn't take deportees, having been labeled dangerous anarchists, they wound up in Moscow, which was a dark period for Goldman, so painful that she and others left Russia after several years in outrage at Bolshevik oppression of workers and peasants, and that was even before Stalin. The documentary showed a famous meeting of Goldman with Lenin. Goldman argued for free speech and assembly in revolutionary Russia. Lenin justified hardline control of workers and peasants, that the revolution could not afford critique or organizing of working people when parts of Russia were occupied by the U.S. and its allies. They actually had an army of occupation in Russia after the revolution, and the U.S. and its allies' armies were supporting the counter-revolutionaries, the Tsarist military, the aristocracy, who had armies seeking to overthrow the communist state. In the documentary, Lenin had the last word. In contrast to failures of war communism, the film did not even mention Goldman's time in Spain supporting the democratic forces led by the anarchists in the Spanish Civil War in 1937. That anarchist organizing an army emerged in Basque Country around Barcelona to fight Spanish fascism, being supported by Hitler's Germany. In that struggle, Goldman was energized and elated, seeing a working-class socialism, including an army that operated democratically, as described in George Orwell's wonderful memoir, Homage to Catalonia. Anarchist Spain inspired Goldman. It validated her dreams. After all, the working class ran and successfully operated a productive economy. It fed, clothed, and sheltered everybody while supplying an anarchist army that was pushing back the fascists. That until that a disciplined anarchist army, but democratically run, the soldiers actually decided on the tactics, and they would succeed. That until they were sabotaged by Stalin, got no help from England and the U.S. Damned if the elites of the capital states would support those undisciplined anarchists. And the Spanish loyalists and anarchists were ultimately defeated on the ground by the Spanish fascists, who became dependent on Hitler's military and weaponry. Anarchist Spain in the war, the Paris Commune for a time, thousands of community institutions starting in early modern Europe and around the world. They are examples of radically democratic functioning. For example, successful worker-owned and managed cooperatives, some schools, individual churches too, even sports teams where the players themselves develop strategies based on their strengths and weaknesses, and the coach operates mostly as a coordinator. These all affirmed Goldman's socialist optimism and gives a lie to the smug historians and other academics who see her as naive. Unfortunately, the documentary ignored Goldman's experience in Spain and her continued devotion to workers' democracy and the capacity of ordinary people to meaningfully participate in running society. Emma Goldman, a dangerous woman, it carried, unfortunately, a conservative message, basically seeing Goldman as, a well-meaning woman, committed, passionate, a great intellect, but naive, foolhardy in her enthusiasms. Indeed, some of the historians question her motives, wondering if she was a radical because of a terrible authoritarian father she fled at age 15, or because of an overdeveloped ego that propelled her to great fame as the most dangerous person in America. When Emma Goldman arrived in this country 16 years old, having to learn English, she found a miserable work with so many other women, U.S.-born immigrants too, in a textile factory. That she was motivated by a deep sympathy and appreciation for her fellow workers, that she was outraged by capitalist exploitation and suppression of workers whose great human capacities were smothered and lives shortened, that Goldman loved her fellow workers and had confidence in their decency and capacities for building a democratic worker state, that Emma Goldman, these elite academics could hardly imagine. They had to speculate about psychological reasons for Goldman's life choices and commitments. To conclude, the film offered a liberal capitalist sensibility about human capacity. The talking heads expressed their prejudices that educated, disciplined elites must rule. There's lots of room for a far more interesting and truthful documentary, although the one playing tonight is worth seeing. It's actually quite inspiring, even those glimpses of Goldman. For you filmmakers, there's lots of material to use, especially from Goldman herself, that anticipates the world of today. For we all face a great challenge to reconstruct society in response not just to the capitalist predation, but the kind of predation that's creating a looming environmental and climate cataclysm threatening human life. We now have no choice but to build new societies, working together, finding satisfaction in rich lives of learning and participation, with much less overall consumption. Emma Goldman, 80 years after her death, remains an inspiration to us today. Her story and the lessons she learned and the commitments to a radical democracy, they illuminated the challenges we face. Actually, Emma Goldman's story could make a really good movie. Anyway, it's playing tonight. I recommend it. It actually is inspiring. You just have to sort of see the hidden liberal assumptions. Thanks a lot, Bill Resnick, for The Old Mole.
She told me the state is my enemy. The lady on the left saying proper.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Anne Feeney, Emma Goldman, from her If I Can't Dance album. Later in the show, Bill Resnick will be talking about the political and social position of students as a broad class of people in society today. But for the next piece, I want you to just listen. If you didn't know, that was the sound of a traditional meditation gong. And if you work for a corporation or a public institution, or if you have health insurance, or if you look at the magazines at the checkout stand at the grocery store, you've probably heard of mindfulness. And not just as a religion, but what some have dubbed MIC mindfulness, a workplace stress reduction strategy. And I have Guy Berliner on today to talk with me about mindfulness in corporate America. But also, hopefully, if we have time, mindfulness as a factor in social and political movements. Thanks for coming on the show, Guy.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
So could you say a little bit about your background with meditation and social activism, and we can kind of talk about our shared perspective on bringing them together?
Yeah, I've been involved in a variety of social movements over the years, and I guess I got my first introduction to meditation and Zen and Buddhism in my 20s, once upon a time reading Alan Watts. And at some point I stumbled upon Roshi Philip Kaplow, who said something in his Three Pillars of Zen to the effect that Alan Watts was the worst thing that ever happened to Buddhism and meditation, because it made it sound like all you had to do was just read a book. And then it dawned on me, well, maybe I actually need to try this meditation practice out. But the other factor I'd say with social movements is I've noticed over the years that, you know, they tend to attract a lot of angry people because there's a lot of things to be angry about, but anger only takes us so far, and I've noticed that it can be toxic. And you know, I kind of combined that with my meditation practice, thinking, well, there must be some way that we can bring these two together in a productive dialogue.
Well, I've been meditating for some years, but I didn't really go on a long retreat until just this last year when I had a baby and had time off to do that. My experience with it was, you know, always kind of intellectual, even though I would sit and follow my breath. I had not done it long enough to really make a discernible change that I saw associated with the practice, but it still inspired me. And when I finally had the opportunity to go to a meditation course where I very intensively and extensively practiced meditation, I was shaken to my core, but also brought together. And now there's been a number of articles and radio pieces coming out about mindfulness as a corporate tool for making workers able to continue to do their work, to at least keep productivity levels at where they are, if not increase them. Could you say a bit about these techniques and how they cut away from the larger tradition that mindfulness comes from?
Yeah, I think that as with anything, a tool or a technique can be wrested from its origins and applied to something that is novel and not necessarily what the original intentions were for that tool or that technique. And the same thing happens with other religious traditions, right? With Christianity, we see that there are people who espouse this prosperity theology, which is almost turning the teachings of Jesus on their head. There is danger of anything kind of being perverted for self-aggrandizement, for example. And there is, I think, a danger that, you know, we've been discussing with mindfulness techniques being kind of divorced from the bigger context of the society and of an authentic practice, because authentic spiritual practices, meditation practices, are not completely divorced from everybody else. They're not completely inward, and they involve interacting with other human beings.
Though before we say more about that context, we probably should just say a little bit about the technique, because that, if it is not the whole, it's the starting point.
Yes. When we talk about mindfulness, we're talking about awareness. And by awareness, we mean just that. We mean being aware of this moment, my bodily sensations.
And that's where it really starts. It starts with our sensations. It's why the breath is the choice. It is it's constantly producing a sensation for us to practice with.
Yes.
That by becoming aware of our bodily sensations and really our embodiment, we are able to integrate our awareness of the wider environment of both what is happening outside of and inside of us, and that awareness, you know, it starts with something simple and we build it. We all have awareness, but we don't necessarily practice using it.
That's right. I mean, we take it for granted all of the time. And it's unfortunate because, particularly in our society, and I think this is one of the points that I'm really troubled by, is that we are in danger of a lot of sensory overload. There are too many sources of stimuli, and when you are overstimulated, your senses are really deadened.
And if your senses are deadened, then you're less able to pay attention and stay on task.
Yes.
And that's where the corporate response with mindfulness comes from. It's them recognizing in this practical way that our workers are bombarded with sensations, with demands, with not enough resources. And so the corporate promotion of mindfulness is about getting workers to be able to show up for work and to serve the interests of the corporation, the business, the institution.
Yes, and Philip Kaplow, in that book, Three Pillars of Zen, he talks about the various sort of stages of Zen, you know, and the lowest level, the first stage that he mentions is what Bompu Zen. So Bompu Zen is exactly what you're talking about. It's applying meditation, following the breath, and with no other aspiration aside from, like you say, not being so strung out, enjoying some benefits of serenity, of greater well-being physically and emotionally. And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's a place you start. You know, learn to take care of yourself, and once you have found more equanimity, then you are able to work with others, building that equanimity interpersonally then.
That's right. I mean, it can lead to a whole world way beyond what your initial aspirations are.
Mm-hmm.
And in that book, you know, in the Three Pillars of Zen that I mentioned, the master that Philip Kaplow took, it's a series of interviews with this Zen master, and he asked people at the beginning, what are your aspirations? You know, and so the aspirations can be everything from, you know, I want to improve my own physical and emotional well-being, all the way to I want to save all sentient beings, you know, and anything in between. But the possibilities are really awe-inspiring. You can start with this germ of purely self-regarding desire for your own personal well-being, and you can move from there to the aspiration to save sentient beings. And that happens to a lot of people. I can attest to that experience myself. I mean, you know, when I started practicing Zen, I didn't have particularly awe-inspiring aspirations, but there is a lot in Zen and in Buddhism that can make your life a lot more meaningful beyond just, you know, feeling more relaxed. The point, though, about mindfulness practice is dropping any kind of attachment to any, you know, goal, right? You can't go into the practice that we're talking about with the idea that you're going to achieve X, Y, and Z. It's not political, right? I mean, we can't expect any set of desirable things out of it, right? But ironically, what we can realize out of it is something incredibly precious and liberatory.
And that experience is what drives us to want to share that experience, which is what then becomes the propelling factor in engaging with the external world.
I think potentially it is. I think in, you know, the ideal circumstances, that can be, and that often is what happens. People have this experience and they sometimes have a sense of elation and a deep desire to share it with others.
Unfortunately, we don't have enough time to get more into how mindfulness meditation can factor into social and indeed political movements for positive, progressive social change. I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thank you, Guy Berliner, for coming on to talk about meditation as corporate control and for social change.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That is, as every true American knows, the Rocky theme. And Movie Mole's Denise Morris and Jan Hocken up next are going to be talking about this American classic boxing film in light of myths and pseudo-realities of American greatness. Later in the show, Jan Hocken will return to talk with Sophie Smith about the trial of Scott Warren in Tucson, who was tried for helping refugees not die in the desert. I'm going to hand it over now, though, to Denise to talk about this great American classic. Denise?
Thank you, Joe. Indeed, this great American classic showed recently on the big screen at the Hollywood Theater as part of a benefit, and I was able to go and see it and was inspired to talk about it this July 4th season, as it does bring a lot to the table when it comes to American ideology. So the film was released in 1976, the year of the U.S. Bicentennial, and Rocky follows the journey of Rocky Balboa, a struggling boxer trying to make ends meet, working as a debt collector for a low-level loan shark in the depressed working-class neighborhoods of Philadelphia. When heavyweight champion Apollo Creed visits Philadelphia, he convinces his managers to set up a title fight between him and a local boxer. "This is the land of opportunity, right?" Creed says. He wants a Snow White underdog. And because Creed is sentimental, and a lot of people in the country are sentimental, on this country's birthday, he will give a local boy a shot at the title. "I like it. It's very American," says the promoter. "It's very smart," replies Creed. They, of course, pick Rocky Balboa, the Italian stallion, because, quote, "Who discovered America? The Italians. What would be better than to get it on with one of their descendants?" While the first half of the film introduces Rocky, where he lives, who he hangs out with, his love interest, and how he makes a living, the second half is dedicated to his training for the chance of a lifetime in the, quote, "land of opportunity." This premise has been criticized since the film's release as pure make-believe at best, but the gimmick of giving a local fighter a shot at the title in the land of opportunity on this country's birthday is the core ideological engine of the film. And with the 4th of July's Independence Day lurking around the corner, we do want to look at the themes in Rocky that perpetuate the mythologies that link individualism to loyalty to the prevailing system. Jan, Independence Day is marked by unending displays of patriotism, American exceptionalism, and militarism. So to begin here, we wanted to talk a bit about the way the Rocky franchise has been used in the U.S. military in training soldiers to stay in the fight in the face of long wars and multiple deployments.
Well, I discovered the propaganda power of the Rocky film franchise when I was producing a documentary on mental health in the military in 2011 and filming a scene on resilience training for the Army National Guard. There were 60 or so Army Guard members there with trainers explaining how to stay mentally positive even through militarily demoralizing multiple deployments. The trainer begins the afternoon session by introducing a segment from Rocky Balboa from 2006. And he explains somewhere along the line, he says, you're going to watch a movie and you're going to find a message and it's going to mean something to you. And for him, it was Rocky Balboa. So he plays a 2-minute clip, an inspirational speech that the aging Rocky by now gives to his son. And this is a quote from the clip. I held you in my arms, watched you grow and take on the world, which you did. But life isn't easy. It's tough and mean and will beat you to your knees if you let it. It ain't about how hard you get hit, but how you keep moving forward, how you can take it and keep moving forward. You can't blame others. Cowards do that. And that ain't you. So the trainer then starts discussion with his own commentary. Rocky Balboa is a story about what we're talking about here today. We don't quit, right? Now, Rocky's talking about fighting in the ring, but that's not his message to his son because his son's not a fighter, right? He was telling his son to quit being a baby. Life is hard. So my own commentary on that day and that scene was how much Rocky as a character embodies what I came to think of as the new Army mental health program, that there's a lot of more focus on nurture and care of soldiers, because after all, it is an all-volunteer Army and you have to get people to keep submitting, going into the ring and submitting to this brutal, unending mission ambiguous war, but at the same time that Rocky is this tender-hearted character who loves animals, sensitive to his agonizingly shy girlfriend, he is unleashes an indomitable force when he enters the ring. And so it's a kind of confined, controlled violence that we see, and as masochistic as it is sadistic in a way. And so I think the Rocky character is not just about a traditional patriarchal masculine violence. It's about a kind of ambivalent, conflicted violence and the suffering of working class, in this case, white men, as well as their potential for violence.
Right. And you mentioned a couple of important pieces of this. Many writers at the time the film was released, and many of these articles are archived, we can link to them on our site, wrote about the racism, this kind of simple yet complex racism in the film. And part of that
with Creed character.
Right, with the Creed character, yeah. But also other characters that have a measure of success against this kind of pushing out or replacement of white working class by successful blacks, either at the level of the boxing world or Creed's particular advancements. And also the female reporter at one point, there's a female reporter in interviewing Rocky, who is a black woman. So there's been a lot of writing about how these pieces of the film come together.
And the appeal to ethnic minorities that are kind of on the margins between whiteness and blackness, and their grievances are there was an appeal to their grievances during the 70s, this idea that they've been displaced by affirmative action and a rising mm-hmm. Black Power movement.
But in spite of all of this, of course, the reviews and the success of the film was immeasurable. It was so, so huge, winning an Academy Award, et cetera. I found this great quote. It's, quote, "Our wish to have the best rescued from depravity comes true in the enchanting role of Rocky Balboa." So there's a commitment to this kind of rise of the individual, and this and that opportunity is very individualized in the film. There's not really a sense of a collective struggle at all. So
yeah, and I think also that it's interesting to trace the fate of female characters throughout the whole series of, what are they, eight of them now, eight or nine Rocky films.
Oh, there's tons.
Adrian was like agoraphobic, you know, agonizingly mm-hmm. shy and fearful, and then finally becomes the supportive wife over the, and yet the subtext of a lot of these films is these are men that are very dependent on the mirroring effect of wives, girlfriends, mothers. And at the end, though, the mother, even with this last one, Creed, that had a more developed story for the wife who had a life of her own, her story is canceled out at the end. So it does follow a trajectory of male development mm-hmm. under patriarchy, where there's a kind of repression by the end mm-hmm. of a course of development of the dependency mm-hmm. on women to yeah. sustain them.
And one of the most interesting moments in the film is when Creed comes out for the fight, you know, back to the original Rocky, and he's donned these really inflammatory symbols of American might and greatness. He comes out as George Washington floating on a boat, and he's got the wig and everything. Once he gets to the ring, he's disrobed from that and now is dressed in full flag attire as Uncle Sam, going around saying, "I want you, I want you." And there's an interesting...
That could be read a couple
yeah,
ways.
Yeah, it could very be read very couple ways. But that's what's interesting about this film, I think, because it both illuminates the real grittiness of the environment and also the kind of cynicism about the symbols of American success. And in fact, Creed says at one point, you know, don't become a fighter, be a thinker, you know. So the path, but again, the pathway, of course, is very individualized towards success. And there's... obviously something greatly appealing about this film to people, in American culture. It's iconic, and yet
and it does
very
have
troubled.
Some interesting scenes as he's training through the streets of Philadelphia, which apparently is not realistic about
right,
the
yeah.
the different neighborhoods of Philadelphia.
Right.
So it's we're seeing there certainly different ways of reading it.
Right. Well, that's our Reader's Digest version of Rocky and 4th of July, Independence Day. Let's celebrate with a big. Big no to militarism. Okay.
Yeah,
this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Denise Morris and Jan Hocken
talking.
It is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I am your host, Joe Clement. Up next, we're going to turn it over back to Bill, who has some things to say about the position of students in our society today and what that means for building movements to change the world. Bill?
Yes. So I've been reading. I'm here today to offer a well-read read, an article, The Rise of the Student Worker, from the journal Red Pepper, published in London, England, a wonderful journal that concentrates on working in movements from below, like labor movement, environmental movement for radical ends, like reconstructing the society towards security of income, worker power, participatory democracy, with ordinary folks having meaningful roles in the decisions that shape their lives. The article starts pointing out that much of the labor movement defines the old labor movement defines the working class as wage workers, these higher ed students in rebellion, as just self-indulgent expression of young people destined for privilege in the capitalist hierarchy. The article finds this view narrow, sectarian, counterproductive, no longer relevant. It contends that a critical eye to the student body today calls into question these assumptions. It contends that today's neoliberal capitalism, cutting support for working class people, has changed the lives of students too, that neoliberalism has produced a generation whose interests, everyday experience, including their income resources for schooling, living standards, it puts this new generation in opposition to that neoliberal system. The article demonstrates that one major change is in the size of the student populations and their backgrounds. Between 1992 and 2018, the proportion of people aged 16 to 24 in full-time education increased to close to 50%. That's much the same in the United States, and far more young high school graduates are enrolled part-time in continuing education. At the same time, government changes to the organization funding and overall function of education have fundamentally transformed the position of the students in the class structure of the society. The article then discusses the state policies that force the students to work far more hours and struggle to get by. It first notes the abolition of grants, instead the introduction of loans that barely cover living costs. The cut in the student grants has driven 80% of the students to part-time work, up from a little over 50 only 5 years ago, often in the poorly paid service sectors. The identity of the student as a student has been slowly degraded as a result. Instead of using their time to further their studies, socialize, make art, organize politically, 9 out of 10 of those students work at least 20 hours a week, earning an average of about $500 a month. Nearly 90% also said that taking on work while studying was necessary to get a job afterwards in a labor market glutted with degree holders. Higher education is no longer a key to the professional classes, but also could mean decades of dead-end service jobs and dead-end jobs while trying to pay off their loans. The article on the new student worker generation concludes, arguing that the greatest threat to Britain's financialized capitalism resides in the new social sector of young student workers who have been increasingly pushed to the left as the uneven effects of capitalist crisis increasingly impinge on them. Their early entry into wage labor, the forcible imposition of debt without any corresponding offer of assets, has transformed the student body into something unrecognizable even 50 years ago. Students are more likely now to experience a life of debt, increasing precarious employment, than go on to run daddy's business or take a professional job. With little to gain from the existing system, these new radicalizing social subjects, students are crucial sources for hope and strengthening any future socialist project. Well, I say amen. That's hoping to broaden the movement.
This is Joe Clement for the Ulmo Variety Hour. Thanks, Bill, for that very interesting commentary on student life today. Up next, to wrap up today's show, Jan Hocken returns to talk with Sophie Smith about humanitarian aid workers and specifically Scott Warren, who was tried for just leaving food and water out in the desert for refugees crossing in borderlands. It was a troubling decision, and they're going to talk about what went into it. Jan?
Welcome back to the Old Mole, Sophie Smith.
Thanks, Jan. It's a joy to be here.
Well, in a trial in Tucson closely watched around the globe, a jury last month failed to convict humanitarian aid worker Scott Warren. Warren, a volunteer for the aid group No More Deaths, faced 3 felony charges tied to his arrest on January 17, 2018 in Ajo, Arizona, for helping 2 undocumented migrants. Warren pleaded guilty to one. We'll talk about the pleas in a bit. But the jury was split with 8 in favor of acquittal and 4 against. So, Sophie, as a humanitarian aid worker yourself, living and working in the U.S. borderlands, you have witnessed for years scenes of border policing and threats and violence that residents and others providing humanitarian aid face. What was significant about this case against Scott Warren? And could you say a little at the beginning about the charges against him.
Yeah, sure, of course. So I think the important thing to know about Scott's case is what he's accused of doing is something that happens every day across the borderlands. U.S. border policy has really concentrated on deflecting people away from ports of entry who are attempting to cross into the U.S., from Mexico, from Central America, and border policy has really been focused on policing, so pushing people into more and more deadly crossings through extremely remote areas. So this is happening on a daily basis in the borderlands and has been going on for about 25 years. Scott's case is significant, however, because this is the first federal prosecution of a humanitarian aid worker since 2005, since the Bush administration. So we're definitely seeing an orientation of the U.S. Attorney's Office towards trying to more aggressively restrict the kinds of basic relief that can be provided in the borderlands. So Scott is charged with two counts of harboring and one conspiracy charge in connection to the government's complaint was that he was providing food, water, beds, and blankets to Christian and Jose, two men from Central America, who are also receiving medical care at a known aid station in the town of Ajo, where Scott lives, at a location known as The Barn. That's a widely known humanitarian relief location. And so that's some of the context of the case.
So many in the media, and I think there was even an announcement on No More Deaths declaring this hung jury a victory. What's your assessment of the outcome?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's difficult in the sense that many of us sitting through the trial for a couple of weeks in federal court in Tucson, where it was dawning on us how weak the government's case was. I mean, what we were witnessing here in the Ajo corridor. So Ajo is a tiny town that lies about 40 miles north of the border, directly north of several federal land jurisdictions that are completely unpopulated, swaths of very harsh desert. So people who are attempting to enter the U.S. on foot are crossing through a very, very threatening area. I was just looking at remains recoveries. There's been 59 recoveries of people who have died in this area alone in 2019. Scott himself has encountered at least 18 people who have died in these deserts. So this is a very, very deadly place. And Scott's case is really not about him. It's really about all of us living in these areas and what we can provide in terms of mitigating these kinds of harms and threats to life. So I think as the government's case was unfolding, it was very uncanny because essentially what the lines of argument were things like, so did Dr. Warren, Scott has a PhD, by the way, did Dr. Warren provide you the water? Did he pour you the glass of water? Or did you pour your own water? This is to Christian and Jose. Did he prepare your food? Or did you prepare your own food? So we see a government effort to really focus in on basics like water, food, medical care as constituting harboring crime. So once it became clear in court that these were really the terms that they were looking to criminalize, there was a lot of hope of an acquittal.
Because the bar was so low.
Certainly. Yes, and we're talking about basic relief at this point. And so the interesting thing about humanitarian aid is that there really isn't much case law on this issue. So aid workers, border residents are working in a terrain that's very ambiguous legally and having to make a lot of guesses at what the legal guidelines are for
this provision.
What are
the legal guidelines for humanitarian aid? There's international law related to refugees.
Sure. And we work with organizations, No More Deaths, Ajo Samaritans, People Helping People. All these organizations uphold Red Cross Code of Conduct standards. These are not explicitly civil disobedience projects. In fact, this is about harm reduction and impartial relief and universal relief. So while the trial is concerning in terms of the kind of negative precedent a conviction could set, there was a lot of hope for the positive precedent of what an acquittal could set. So if convicted, Scott's case would have set sort of the first precedent just within the district. This wasn't the Ninth Circuit or the Supreme Court, but within the district, if convicted, there would have been the precedent that essentially providing a glass of water to someone you encounter who is undocumented could constitute a federal harboring crime, a felony. And so this extends into the interior in terms of perhaps an undocumented mother serving a meal to her child who was born in the United States constituting harboring. So these are really scary precedents. On the other hand, we would have a lot of clarity with an acquittal about sort of some legal parameter and some protection for these acts of care that are ongoing every day. So this was a fight to win. This wasn't simply a case of government repression. There's government repression happening every day in that same courthouse as they conduct speed trials of people who are being charged with criminal entry and re-entry, tried en masse, shackled, being tried, convicted, and sentenced in the space of an hour. You know, that's really a scene of repression. This was something else. This was us pursuing some kind of precedent, some kind of protection through the justice system. And so a hung jury sort of leaves us to wonder, you know, what's next. So tomorrow the prosecution will announce whether or not they are choosing to retry Scott. If they decide to not retry Scott, it will be dismissed without prejudice, which means they could retry at any time. So we don't really know what to expect. The jury was split 8-4, 8 for acquittal, 4-4 conviction. So yeah, tomorrow is a big day.
And border politics have come onto center stage quite literally with the Democratic candidates, and surprising to many, quite a call for decriminalizing border crossing with Julian Castro, you know, a candidate from Texas, who proposed to repeal a federal law, 1325, in the immigration code that makes it a crime to cross the border without authorization. Mm-hmm. That's kind of stunning in a way, and I think many people are not aware of that distinction between mm-hmm. a criminal code and applying civil law to border crossing. Can you say a little about that?
Certainly, and I'm not a lawyer, but I do work in an area where I have to be
and I'm not,
these
I'm,
issues.
I'm not a real doctor, but I give medical advice all the time.
But I was really encouraged to see some discussion of 1325. I mean, that's a section of federal code that's really familiar to those of us working in the region. So essentially, it is a relatively new fact of history that crossing into the U.S. between ports of entry or recrossing is a federal crime, a misdemeanor, or a felony. It used to be that it was a civil infraction, just like being in the U.S. without documents is a civil infraction. And so it became a law, I think 70 or 80 years ago, but really started to be enforced post 9/11. And by criminalizing migration, then allows for criminal sentencing to occur. So we get the construction of this vast system of detention centers, immigration prisons that are widely run by for-profit entities. So the notion of decriminalizing migration would really dismantle that system that people are now pointing a finger at very loudly around child separation, family incarceration. But honestly, that system was really constructed under the Bush administration and ballooned under the Obama administration. So I was glad to see some substantive discussion of these kinds of changes, because honestly, it's a little bit demoralizing to watch Democratic candidates denounce child separation when those of us working, you know, in the border zone providing direct relief are have been doing so under the Obama administration for a long time and are very familiar with these policies, these punitive and policing-based policies directed towards people seeking safety as being really bipartisan initiatives in which there's been broad consensus. And we even hear that some on the Democratic stage of touting, well, I passed a bill that included $48 billion of spending for border security. Well, that, you know, if we want to talk about family separation, we need to talk about stopping having people die and disappear in U.S. deserts. So it was really good to see that kind of discussion on the national stage.
And we'll see more of that history and many of the untold stories of living in the border zones in a film you were part of that'll be screening next week. It's called Undeterred. And it's screening on Thursday, July 11th at the Ainsworth United Church of Christ in Portland, one of the earliest sanctuary church congregations in Portland. And Sophie, you're in the film, and you'll be there as part of the Q&A afterwards so people can learn more about that. And certainly we'll learn more about the history of history of the border and policing the border in that film. It's called Undeterred. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Jan. It's a pleasure.
Well, that's all the time for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host, Joe Clement. Thanks to our guests, Sophie Smith and Jan Hocken, for talking about these important issues happening at the border and in our country. Thanks to Denise and Jan for talking about Rocky and its messages about American possibilities in America. Thanks to Bill Resnick for doing both a review of the American Experience PBS documentary on Emma and for commenting on the social situation and politics of student life in the country today. And thanks to Guy Berliner for coming on to talk with me about mindfulness meditation under corporate capitalism. You can find The Old Mole at kboo.fm/oldmole. You find past episodes, either the whole thing or different segments, and you can share them as you want. There's usually extra links to stuff if it matters. You can find us on Facebook just by looking up The Old Mole Variety Hour, and you can find us that way on Twitter. We post content. We sometimes post other things. We'll let people know about upcoming shows. If you'd like to get involved with The Old Mole Variety Hour, if you'd like to do interviews, if you'd like to do reviews, have something important to say about making the world a better place from the bottom up, please email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. We also like your questions and suggestions that aren't so involved. You can listen to us next week, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland.